Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Meredith Monk. Monk is a composer, singer, director, choreographer, and creator of new opera, music theater works, films, and installations. She is a pioneer in what is now called extended vocal technique and interdisciplinary performance. Since graduating from Sarah Lawrence College in 1964, Monk has been the recipient of numerous awards, including the MacArthur Genius Award in 1995 and two Guggenheim Fellowships. Her most recent CD, Impermanence, was released on the ECM series label in March of this year. I'm speaking to Meredith Monk by phone from her home in central New York. Meredith Monk, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be on the phone with you, Tish.
Now, you've said that your first language was singing. Tell us about these beginnings.
Well, my mother was a singer. She was a commercial singer on radio. She was the original Muriel Cigar and Blue Bonnet Margarine, Schaefer Beer, things like that. Hmm. And my grandfather had a music conservatory and was also a classical singer from Russia. So I think that my early life was filled with music, and it seemed to have been my first language, naturally.
And you said in your biography that you were born with an eye challenge where you needed to learn coordination. Tell us that story.
Well, I was born with, I guess it's called strabismus, where you can't fuse two images, so I basically still look out of one eye at a time. But, you know, my eyes are fairly straight now, but they weren't as a child. So I think that that affected my right-left coordination, you know, my depth perception. So my early training was in Dalcroze Eurythmics, which is a system that was developed by a Swiss man at the end of the 19th century to teach children music through the body, through rhythms in the body. But I think for me, music was such a natural language for me that it was actually teaching me my body through the music.
That's fascinating to me. Now, you approach the voice so differently than most people. And I read that you had a revelation in the 60s that voice could have a fluidity and flexibility just like the body.
That's right.
Tell us more about those connections.
Well, I had, through my childhood, I'd sung and, you know, I'd studied piano and, you know, I was doing a lot of music as a child, but I was also doing a lot of movement. And when I went to Sarah Lawrence College, I was both in the voice department and in the dance department there. And I think because of my physical limitations, I was able to come up with my own very idiosyncratic movement style and choreography. You know, in a way, sometimes limitations are to your advantage. So I developed a way of working, and I developed a style of movement. And I was starting to work a little bit with the voice in creating pieces that had the voice as one element, you know, as well as movement and visual images and light and, you know, like a kind of, I had a glimpse of weaving these elements together. And then when I went to New York, I did a lot of pieces in galleries and churches, you know, kind of alternative spaces, but I really miss the straight out singing. So I started sitting down at the piano and vocalizing, and one day I had a kind of revelation that the voice could be an instrument and that I could find a vocabulary built on my own voice the way that I had with my body. So in a way, I had the method of how to work on it, but because of my family background, I had a much more virtuosic vocal instrument, and so I just started working with it, exploring my range, how I could pull the range up and down. And, you know, at the same time, I was very aware of the voice as, you know, within it could be male and female and landscapes and characters and different sounds, using the breath in different ways. And also at that moment, I think I realized this was coming back to my family line, you know, my family lineage in my own way, which was hard to find in a family of singers.
Yeah. I'll bet. Now, you know, your public career began in the early 60s. Was your early voice honed with a kind of a backdrop of politics?
Well, I think that I came to New York in 1964, and I wouldn't say politics in a direct way, but I would say that the spirit of the time was very much anything is possible. And I was a very imaginative young person, and, you know, I needed to work. I mean, it was like a kind of urgency for me. And so that spirit was so supportive of me wanting to explore and, you know, willing to go into the unknown. And, you know, I think that that was something everybody at that time, we were so lucky to have that. And also, there was an atmosphere of visual artists trying to do dance pieces and musicians doing plays and poets doing, you know, music pieces. I mean, there was that kind of exploration of breaking down the boundaries of what we thought the separate art forms were and kind of using the same principles that you had as, say, if you were a sculptor, well, you'd do a dance piece that had a sculptural kind of quality to it. And I think that was a great time to come to New York.
Oh, I can imagine. I bet the sense of freedom was enormous, but
exactly.
You probably didn't even know it until you were in it.
That's right. And so in a way, I would say that's, you know, it's political in its own way, you know, because it's, you know, now, as we can see now, you know, things have tightened up on all levels, and I think that it's more imperative that we as artists keep that spirit of, you know, trying to push into the unknown.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does your creative process work? Is it kind of a mysterious excavation that you go through, or do you, is it just everyday experience that, that you
well, find? I think mysterious excavation is really well said. I think ultimately that's what it is, but I always say that, you know, you get these wonderful moments where you feel something's coming through you and you feel that maybe something exists in a different dimension and you're just bringing it to life. But, you know, between that, you have to be a good shoemaker. So, you know, the discipline is very important. And, you know, I'm not sure you get those inspirations if you're not, you know, in a kind of mode of discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So the daily work is for me going to the piano and, you know, and singing and doing a little bit of movement work as a maintenance, but basically it's going to the piano and working. And, you know, in a sense, it's that same explorative mentality and then hoping that there will be these moments of discovery or revelation. You know, in a way, I feel like I live for those moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as most artists I've talked to feel that way. Now, you know what, your creativity seems to always begin, at least in my mind, with a question
that
you're always trying to answer.
I always ask questions that I know can't be answered, and then somehow the piece is just part of that process. But, you know, it's especially these last years, like working on Mercy and Impermanence, you know, I feel also I'm a meditator and have been for many years, and so I feel like part of, you know, the rest of my life is trying to find themes or, you know, or pieces that are both a creative exploration, but at the same time, they're a contemplative exploration of questions that can't be answered.
Mm-hmm. Do you think your exploration is more spiritual than religious?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Indeed.
I agree with you there. Absolutely. So your compositions are kind of like a musical journalism. You're taking us all on a journey that you're also on, and you don't know where you're going to end up, it seems.
Mm-hmm. When I was a younger artist, I started much more with concept, and, you know, there was a whole conceptual framework that I began with. But as I've gotten older, I've, in a way, I'm trusting more going into the material itself. And that, in a way, I guess, again, because of the meditation practice, part of my practice is to try to not be holding on or grasping onto concept.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's like trusting the material itself to tell me what it wants. And, you know, that's a little scary, but, you know, that's the way that it's been going. So, you know, and again, I guess it keeps that level of mystery. I think hanging out in the unknown is also working with your fear,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
I try to start from zero every piece, and there is a period of time that, you know, I'm dealing with my own fear. And usually what happens is that then my interest surpasses the fear, and then I'm into the process of the piece, and I become more interested than fearful.
So you get used to the dark.
I get used to the dark, and I think every creative person has to deal with that in one way or another, unless you're making a kind of product that you already know what it's going to be before you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me is not, you know, I wouldn't really be interested in that, but I'm not putting that way down, but I don't think that there's any reason to do it if you already know what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I
love the mystery of what you do.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Now, tell us about your CD, Impermanence. It's a very interesting personal piece.
The catalyst of the piece was a personal loss, but I think impermanence is something that we all have to deal with as human beings. So I think that personal loss really brought the truth of impermanence to my life, but I think we're all dealing with it. And, you know, one of the things that is an illusion or delusion is that we pretend that it doesn't exist, and I feel like we live our lives that way. And also, I think our society encourages that kind of blindness to the fact that everything's changing and it's fluid, and even including our ideas about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the catalyst to make the piece was a personal loss, but the piece is hardly a personal account of my experience. It's actually really more trying to get down to the essence of impermanence in all of us.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that impermanence prior to this loss?
Well, you know, I think we're always encouraged to think of that. You know, impermanence meaning loss or change or, as I say, a fluidity about ourselves and our own experience. And, I mean, it can be manifest in so many ways. It could be manifest in the way that we even look at other people. That person is, his name is Tom, and Tom is this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've had the experience of breaking up with somebody and then years later you see that same person and they're still treating you like the person you were 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Oh, yes.
You know, and you've changed and you're a different human being than you were at that time. So we also have these ways of fixating ourselves, and that's like a defense to open ourselves to the reality of impermanence and change, which can be seemingly painful, you know, mm-hmm. because we're going to lose, you know, everything we have we will lose, including our own bodies and our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that when we're open to that, that little edge, it's kind of like, you know, the little edge of a very, very sharp knife, and we actually are able to lean into that edge, I think that it makes the way that we live different, because we start understanding the preciousness of the moment and actually the preciousness of our loved ones and are not afraid to acknowledge that, like,
mm-hmm.
in any way.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that you were influenced by the psychologist James Hillman with some of these pieces.
That one piece, Last Song, I use the words that are, it's a kind of litany, you know, of the word last. And James is a friend of mine. He's a wonderful, fierce man. He's 80 years old. He's a very vibrant man at the age of 80. And I was reading a book of his called A Force of Character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically a meditation about aging. And it was a strange thing because I was reading it. I was at the McDowell Colony in New Hampshire about a month and a half after 9/11.
Mm.
And everybody was like in a state. I mean, really, we were... the artists were all wondering, you know, is it really worthwhile doing art? I mean, everybody was kind of thrown into a really hard emotional state, and the McDowell Colony opened their doors to emergencies from people that were literally, you know, having asthma from being near the World Trade Center. There was one young woman whose vocal cords were really hurt by the, you know, she lived right near the World Trade Center, so, you know, from the debris. And, you know, people having emotional breakdowns were coming up to McDowell.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing.
How bad.
And at that time, I was reading A Force of Character. And it's basically a book about how, in our time now, the respect that we have for autonomy has left. You know, in other words, in the old days, when an older person, you could say that they were even grouchy, but, you know, there was kind of a sense of uniqueness and wisdom about older people. And strength of character was really, in a sense, valued. And I think the book is very much about how we've lost some of that.
Mm-hmm.
So this one chapter was talking about our idea of the word last, you know, and what does that actually mean to us. So I just saw that list, and there was something very interesting about it for me, kind of poignant but ironic and also humorous at the same time. And so I wrote down those words, and then I thought it would be really interesting to make a song with that, almost like a litany, but I don't really use words that often in my work.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been very trustful of words in music because I feel that words point out a very specific kind of meaning, and I guess I feel like the voice is such an eloquent language of energies and emotions for which we don't have words. So I decided, well, how would I abstract this? You know, like I would have the words, you'd hear the words, but then they'd start dissolving more into sound.
Mm.
So it's kind of the idea of using words as a fluid form. And this is before I started impermanence. And, you know, I literally was a month and a half after the World Trade Center.
If you're just joining us, my guest is composer and singer Meredith Monk. Now, Meredith, I want to play an excerpt from Impermanence. I want to play a cut called Maybe One.
Great. There's 10 of us playing that.
Let's listen.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, I find that a compelling piano piece, and then you sneak in these otherworldly sounds, as you often do.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about the piece.
Well, basically, it's eight of us playing, and we're all crowded around the piano. So actually, it's something that could be done on the piano that you wouldn't be able to do, certainly with one person. It's got more, the range is wider. And then there are two people that are playing inside the piano.
Wow.
John Hollenbeck and Bodine Hillosh. That's the sounds that seem to come from another reality.
So it's
kind of fun because you can hear that we're not 100% in unison, but as I say, there's 10 of us crowded around, and we decided in the recording studio not to do it by overdubbing, but really do it live.
Wow, it shows. It's really quite amazing.
Thank you.
Now, you've said in the past that you compose mainly for the voice, but now you're allowing yourself to think of instruments as voices. Where did this new perception come from?
I think the real catalyst for that kind of thinking was that I was commissioned to write an orchestral work by Michael Tilson Thomas for the New World Symphony.
Mm.
And it was called Possible Sky, and it was premiered in 2003. And there were many years that I was saying no, no, no to him. I mean, it was really like I was kind of drag kicking and screaming to try to write an orchestral work, because I said to Michael, you know, I just don't know anything about the orchestra. I mean, I'm basically a vocal composer, and you know, I've used a few instruments. I did an opera for Houston Grand Opera, and that was only an 11-piece orchestra and 18 singers. So, you know, we were proportionally, it was more a vocal composition. So little by little, he finally convinced me, and I started studying a little bit of orchestration with a friend of mine, Kirk Nurok, who's a wonderful orchestrator and jazz musician. And I went down to, they're in Miami, I went down and worked with the instrumentalist, kind of the way that I work with my ensemble. So it was about a 3-year process.
Wow.
And I think that's how I started getting really interested, because I, you know, since I've been always working with the extended vocal techniques over the years, the voice as an instrument, I had a lot of fun with the young instrumental players, because they would come and say, you know, I play tuba and I can do this and I can do that. We, you know, they were showing me the flute can do this, and, you know, and I was like, wow, you know. And so little by little, I was able to, I don't feel like I necessarily incorporated all those techniques into my piece, but it just gave me another feeling about the possibilities of the instruments. And I guess I had always felt that I wanted to keep the instrumental writing very, very simple, so the voices would have something where they could be complex, you know, that it was something like almost like a carpet to jump down on or jump off from, or, you know, something very steady.
Mm-hmm.
But little by little, I've just tried to open up much more to the instruments as another complex element.
Hmm.
And it's been wonderful. It's been so much fun.
Oh, bad. Yeah,
yeah.
Interesting expansion of your repertoire. Now, your work taps many emotionally deep places, and you've said that your performance is close to meditation. Now, do you ever censor yourself or decide that you're not ready to be so personal or vulnerable in your work?
You know, I don't actually think of it that way.
Hmm.
You know, it's interesting. I think some people do think the voice is very intimate and, what you know, oh boy, do you feel, you know, is it too exposed? But I guess I feel very differently. I feel that the vulnerability, particularly in performance, and not only in relation to the particular sounds, but also our behavior and how we have to be very, very open and focused at the same time. And I guess that does relate to meditation practice. This pinpoint kind of focus and at the same time open to the moment. I think that's what performing is about, and I think that that's what live performance has that nothing else does have. And I think we need these experiential situations in the life that we're living in this world, because I think that, as I said earlier, I think the society is trying to divert us and numb us to the moment, and that's a very easy way of manipulating people politically if all your experience is secondary.
Mm.
And, you know, you're in the computer all the time, you're on TV all the time, you know, you never can live with a moment of silence. And so I think that the direct communication, and which does include the sense of vulnerability of the performers, that we could fall down, we can sing a bad note, we can, you know, it's got that tightrope kind of alertness to it and kind of generosity of spirit. I think that we need those exchanges now in the world that we're living in, you know, and the vulnerability is definitely part of it.
Now, before we run out of time, I do want to play another excerpt from Impermanence. I want to play Particular Dance.
Right.
This is so different for you. It seems to me.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something about how that happened. And when we were working on the piece Impermanence, which was an interdisciplinary piece, somebody brought into rehearsal an article, I think it was in the Times, about Oregon at that time was passing the law that people could take their own lives.
Oh, yes.
And so there was a woman in the article that said, you know, I just want people to dance a polka when I die. I don't want anybody to be crying or anything. I want people to dance a polka. And so one of the people in my group said, you should go and write a polka. And so I didn't write a polka, but I wrote a kind of a folk dance piece. And we do this full-out dancing in it with each person's reason why it's called Particular Dance is I tried to make a situation where each person's movement quality came out very strongly, like each person's uniqueness in the dance.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to it. I love it. It almost sounds, it has a Spanish influence.
Oh, it's great.
To me.
It was so much fun to make that piece. I just loved
it. Was.
Oh, and actually for the album, you know, there's no real vocals in the live piece because we're dancing. We're just doing those calls, but all the melodies and vocal part of Particular Dance I rewrote for the album. And, you know, I think that's something that all my albums, if the music's been more part of an interdisciplinary work, I always rewrite for an album and enrichen the orchestration and enrichen the material. So the vocal part of it is extremely complicated to sing.
It sounds like it could be, yeah.
Yeah.
It worked.
Yeah,
it
thank
worked.
You. Thank you.
You know, I want to go back to what we were talking about a couple minutes ago, this highly technical, jabbering, faster and faster moving world. Have you been able to incorporate that into your work, or are you resisting it? How has it affected you as an artist?
I think that my instinct is to make my work be an antidote to it, to offer an alternative reality. Because there were a few years, like in the 80s, I was doing pieces that in a sense reflected more the dark part of our reality as I saw it. It was more like, you know, laying out the problem. You know, there were very apocalyptic kind of pieces like The Games, and another one was called Turtle Dreams Cabaret, which was an post-apocalyptic cabaret. And, you know, I was really recent ruins. But then at a certain point, I realized, I don't know if people go home and can do anything with that. Everybody sort of knows the problem on a certain level. So I felt like I'd be more useful as an artist to offer an alternative prototype of the, you know, possibility of human behavior.
That's a great way of reacting.
So, you know, that's what I feel like I need to do now. And, you know, we just did a tour of Brazil. We were in Sao Paulo, and we did Impermanence, and people were on their feet. Men were crying, and I mean, it was like we were shocked. But, you know, I just feel like there is something to give, you know, with that. And I just, you know, feel that that's what I want to do at this point.
Wonderful. I think that's wonderful. Now, your work and career have influenced so many people in the 40-plus years that you've been in the public consciousness. And what would you like your legacy to be?
Wow, that's a great question. Well, you know, I think it would be that art has the potential to heal. And I think, you know, some sense of joy and playfulness in music. And I would also, I always say to these young people that I teach now to really not let anybody tell you that you can't follow your dream. You know, that one can, and it's worth it. You know, even if it's a struggle, it's really worth it in the long run, you know, that you don't get pushed down and go away from what your dream is.
No, that's super.
Yeah.
And have you been able to follow your dream all these many years?
I feel that I have. Uh-huh. No, I feel that I actually have. That's one of the things I've been so fortunate. But I'm not going to say that it hasn't been an incredible struggle, and it still is an incredible struggle, you know, on the practical level. And, you know, it's really, really, really hard. But I don't think I would trade it for anything else. You know, I did a piece for a company in Germany, in Berlin, at the beginning. It was called The Games, and it was for this very big theater company called the Schaubin Ensemble. And they were all really good actors and singers. And they were, you know, they were all living in these very luxurious apartments, and everything was completely secure for them. But, you know, they never had any time to dream. They were almost, you know, they'd be rehearsing on one piece in the day, and at night they'd be performing another piece. And I realized, you know, all of that was great, but really, in a way, maybe you really pay a lot for that sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in a
mm-hmm.
way, our freedom is something that we have, as hard as it is and, you know, as terrifying as it can be as far as, you know, how are we going to survive. I think that's something that does lead to, you know, I would much rather have the freedom.
Mm-hmm. Now we only have a couple of minutes left. Are you working on a new piece with a working title called Songs of Ascension?
Yes, I am.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, that's a piece that has voices and a string quartet, which has been so wonderful to work with. I wrote a piece for Kronos Quartet, like, in 2005, and I wanted to go on with strings, and then, in this one, strings in relation to voices. It was inspired by my friend Norman Fisher, who is a poet, but he was also the head of the San Francisco Zen Center, and he was talking about the poet Paul Celan, the C-E-L-A-N. He was a French poet who was a survivor of World War II. And he talks about these songs of ascent, which are the psalms that were sung when people were walking up the mountain.
Mm.
And that idea that, you know, of worship and or, you know, or acknowledgement of a larger reality and walking up something started to get to be intriguing to me, because I was thinking of also Aztec pyramids and the stupas in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and, you know, why are all these traditions walking up, and why is up good and down bad, and, you know, sort of, and then at the same time, my friend Ann Hamilton, who's a wonderful visual artist, and we had collaborated on Mercy, told me that she was working on a tower, and so the prototype for the piece really in the back of my mind was this tower, and which is a double helix spiral tower. The stairs are a double helix. And so that became a kind of inspiration for the piece. And so we did perform it at Stanford. That was the premiere, Stanford in the theater, Stanford University in California. And then we went up to the tower in Sonoma County, and we did a site-specific version of that. And in March, I'm going to do another site-specific version of it at the Guggenheim Museum, March 5th. And then next fall, we'll do the theatrical version of it in at BAM.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you going to release a CD of some of the music?
Definitely. Playing? You know, we already recorded in the tower, which was unbelievable. So we'll definitely have a CD of that music. I'm so happy with the music.
Well, I hope you'll bring some of your performance to the Ithaca area sometime. We would love to see you.
Yeah, I haven't been there since, let's see, I think I did a solo concert in the late 90s, and I love Ithaca. It's a gorgeous place. I did a little solo concert at Cornell.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, we hope you come back. Can you give some contact information if people want to get in touch with your website? Or?
Yes, please. It's www.meredithmonk.org.
Great. Well, Meredith Monk, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Tish. I hope I get to meet you face to face.
I hope I get to meet you too, Meredith, and I think we'll be able to do that since we live in the same area code.
That's right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.